Yeah, it's here. They come down all this way and miss the heavy traffic. Robert has, as they passed president of San Francisco Zen Center, has a number of significant positions in the city center. Has devoted maybe half of his life to making the practice there and supporting the practice. 6 years at Tassajara, and 20 or so years of living in or near city center. But prior to coming to practice, Robert has a very interesting work going in San Francisco. He was the owner of a bar and pub south of Mission, in the neighborhood in San Francisco. For a while, he made movies, made films. He's also been a writer. And you would think that would be enough for somebody living and working in San Francisco. At one point, Robert said, there must be more to life than all this. So he went to Tassajara and devoted his life to practice. Thank you for coming all this way, Robert, to be with us in the middle of the night and sharing your experiences and listening with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Les. How many people were here about a week ago for the ceremony, the celebration of 50 years of Les's practice? Oh, about half of you. That's, Les was here too. Yes, right. And good. For people who don't know, I came up for that, and I was very much honored to be a part of that. I told this story that I'm going to repeat real quickly. I was a young student at Tassajara, and I was in charge of taking care of the altars and trimming the candles and doing all kinds of stuff like that. And there's a founders hall at Tassajara, and there's a little room where people do those kinds of things. And it's very small, and it has one little window like this that's in a traditional Japanese style with twigs. And I was in that room, and I was always quite, Les used to bring the Canon Doe group down pretty much every summer, I think, and it was a large group, and I was always quite intimidated. I thought, oh my gosh, a real life student of Suzuki Roshi's and is here at Tassajara, and it was always quite wonderful for us students who were there. And so I was working in this little room, and all of a sudden, on the other side of the window came two people, and they're having this conversation. And I realized pretty quickly that it was a very intimate conversation about practice between two people. But I was kind of stuck in this room, and I was only like 2 feet away from them. So I had to stop what I was doing because I didn't want to make any noise. And I had to try to be kind of invisible. So I just said, okay, I'm just going to pretend I'm not here. I'm not listening. I mean, that would be the... of course, I couldn't listen, you know. This person who was talking to Les was talking about some kind of problem or issue they have, and I was trying my best not to pay attention. And then Les said, but Suzuki Roshi once told me, and I was like, okay, I'm going to listen. I have to. And so I put my ear up against the little window there. And he said, well, Suzuki Roshi once said, and for people who are of a certain generation, you know, there was a popular television commercial where people would be at a party and somebody would say, E.F. Hutton says, and then everything would stop, right? So that was my moment. It seemed like everything stopped. And I listened to Les, and he said, well, before, he said, Suzuki Roshi said, before you speak, you should think. Three times. Is what I'm going to say true? Is what I'm going to say beneficial? And is what I'm going to say going to be said at the right time? And I thought, wow, what great advice. And just through that, just in that one encounter, I probably didn't have a conversation with Les until like 20 years later, but that became one of my absolute core practices. And I ended up telling that to literally hundreds of people over the course of the next 20 years. Suzuki Roshi said, did you know? So thank you for that, Les. That was a real gift to me. And in my own practice, it was a real gift for me to be able to have that practice for me and for others. How many times did I get, well, yes, it's true. Yes, I think it's going to be beneficial. So often it wasn't the right time. Right? Right time is actually a very deep question. It's not only, is it the right time for me, is it the right time for whoever I'm talking to? That's maybe more important. Is it the right time in the sense that can I say that in a way that can actually be heard? Can I say whatever I'm going to say in a way that will communicate my intention, my love and respect or maybe frustration? Yeah. So what needs to get communicated? So I'm assuming, well, before I say that, Les told a story the other night that has stuck with me, and it was a story about Suzuki Roshi. And it went something like, Les was a younger practitioner. He went to an event with Suzuki Roshi, and somebody asked Suzuki Roshi, what gives you the right to be the teacher? Or something like that. And Suzuki Roshi said, as Les conveyed it to us, I've had some experience. I've had some experience. And then Les very wonderfully went on to tell us what he thought that meant, a little bit about, fleshed it out a little bit for us. But I kept thinking about that because, as Les just said, I was living in San Francisco for the first 10 years of my life. After college, I came to San Francisco and I jumped into a very busy and wild world, and I did a lot of different things. And at one point, I was standing in this bar and restaurant that my buddy from college and I had started. And by about the second year, it became extremely popular. So the crowd used to show up every night, and it was a big party group, and it was a full bar, and it was just crazy. And I was standing there one night, and I'd probably had a few drinks, and I was looking out over this sea of people, and I was like, I was 34 years old. And some voice, there was some moment of like opening, and it was almost like a voice, but it was a voice that came from within that said, this isn't going anywhere good. This actually isn't going anywhere that you want to go. And I listened to that, and I was like, it felt so true. if this is not going anywhere, even though this is what I've been working for a few years, you know, I'd done some other things, but and it was kind of fun, and we were living, you know, this interesting life. It was not going to go anywhere good. Really good. As good as I needed it to be. You know what I mean? It could have been okay, but it was not going to go anywhere that was going to allow me to manifest, to realize my deepest intention and aspiration for my life. That's what I thought it meant. And I didn't even know what that was. I was like clueless. I had no spiritual practice. I had no religion, no really, not even very much self-awareness at that point. But this voice came. And the next day I went to my partner and I said, "Steve, the only thing I can say," I said, "Steve, I'm getting out of the business. I'm leaving. And the only thing I can say is that I need to have some experiences. That's the only way I could translate this voice that came to me. I need to have some experiences." Somehow I was lucky enough to realize that I needed to be thinking, I needed to be doing something different with my life, and I hadn't had the kind of experiences I need. So I asked Les what I could talk about tonight, and he mentioned something. So that was kind of my preamble. What I'd like to talk about tonight is practicing in Sangha, practicing together in community. So as Les said, I've been involved in the San Francisco Zen Center community for about 23 years, since 1993. And when I left this business, I said my idea was, well, I'm going to go to Asia and I'm going to have some crazy experiences. I wasn't looking for a spiritual practice by any means, but I ended up in a Buddhist monastery in Thailand, and I was very sick when I arrived, and these monks took care of me, and I thought, wow, there's something very interesting about these people. They're actually paying attention to me. They actually seem to be kind of, you know, caring, compassionate, calm, kind. So when I came back to San Francisco, I started looking around for a place, and a friend of mine told me about Tassajara, and I said, "No, I'm not. I don't think Zen is the kind of thing for me. I've heard it's very difficult and really rigid, and you have to follow the schedule and lots of forums." I said, I wasn't ready to do something like that, but she so insisted that she took me down there. She made a reservation for me, and that was a long time ago. I started practicing. So I've been practicing now in a spiritual community. And taking responsibility for that spiritual community in various ways as part of my practice. And I've benefited tremendously from that. So I'd like to talk a little bit about that, just a little bit about that tonight. The other thing I thought of as I was thinking about this story that Les told about I've had some experiences, it made me think of a passage from Dogen's Shobogenzo. So Dogen Zenji was the founder of Soto Zen who lived in Japan in the 13th century, and he wrote some teachings that formed a large book, and one of that we call the Shobogenzo, and one of the first chapters of the Shobogenzo is called the Genjo Koan, actualizing the fundamental point, and it's about taking our practice into everyday activity of our life. And in this fascicle from the Shobogenzo, Genjo Koan, there's a great many kind of metaphorical pictures created, like birds flying in the sky and fish swimming in the water, and there's one passage that's extremely metaphorical and hard to understand and grasp, and then there's a sentence that goes, when we find our place where we are, practice occurs. When we find our place where we are, practice occurs. Actualizing the fundamental point. And then Dogen goes on to talk more about the birds and the fish and the sky and the water. But I love that. That's like the key for me. That's a touchstone for practice. It's like when we find our place where we are, and this for me is very similar. When we have the experience, when we actually have the experience of just this body and mind, just these circumstances. When we return, to just this, when we find our place right here, right now, practice occurs. And I think in the same way that when Suzuki Roshi said, when I heard Les say of Suzuki Roshi said, I have some experience, I thought, well, I could do that. I could have some experience. Yeah. That's not too big for me. I could probably do that. Similar to this, when we find our place where we are, I think I could try to do that. Find my place, experience what it's like to just be right here. I could try that. So what I found is that there are, you know, so many benefits to being in a residential sangha. So I've been practicing. I'm assuming that maybe many of you haven't practiced in a residential center with a schedule and like 80 people. I know Carolina has and Les has, maybe some other people, but it's a very unusual experience. And I was thinking tonight that there's at least four benefits that I could mention of being in that kind of environment. You know, the first thing I did on my path was to have that experience, like I just said, of needing to have experiences. And the second one was ending up in this monastery in Thailand and saying, you know, As long as it feels good, I'm going to take the next step. So I was lucky, I was fortunate that I could have the freedom to do that, but still, I needed to do it. I mean, I did it. I kind of made that deal, bargain with myself. So living in community, living in Sangha, so Sangha is this community of practitioners, and sometimes people want to think of it as just the ordained disciples of the Buddha or a teacher, but actually in Zen we have a very broad and inclusive sense of Sangha. In fact, it's not only people, but it's everything. It can be the trees and the mountains and the rivers and the birds and the fish. So one benefit of coming to practice in Sangha and following the schedule, being with a lot of people you don't really know, people who you wouldn't choose necessarily to be with, you know, people who have a whole range of different kinds of backgrounds and a range of different kinds of ideas about what they're trying to do with their practice. So it's a pretty complicated environment. And what I've noticed that it really encouraged me to do is let go of my fixed ideas about myself and about other people. Let go of my fixed ideas about how things should go. You know, practicing intimately with other people, you really don't have a lot of control. You know, you have to harmonize, you have to cooperate. You have to listen really well. You have to try to understand from their perspective, well, what's going on here? And it's very intense in that way because there's a lot of interaction, a lot of cooperation. And the only way you can kind of, you know, start to thrive in that situation is to really notice when you're getting caught by your attachments and fixed views about who you are, who I am, and who they are. Otherwise, it's kind of terrible. But if you just let that go and you're not, you know, then you enter the situation where, you know, I'm not so sure who I am. Who are you? If it's more like that, then it can start to work. So that's one thing. That was a big practice for me. Because I really like to control my situations. And control is not possible when you live together in a Sangha, a residential Sangha with people. The second thing is, I started to notice how kind of passive I was with my life. It's not that I wasn't very active and moving and doing a lot of things, but I was very passive with noticing and questioning and examining what was going on internally with me in relationship to everything around me. In a way, I was just, before I came to practice, I was sleepwalking through life. And that was okay. The world allowed that in some ways. Because I could just keep moving on from thing to thing, person to person. But, you know, when you're practicing together with a group of people, almost like with a family, you know, you have to pay attention. moment to moment to moment. You can't be lazy, or people notice it. You can't just blow people off. You can't not meet. I mean, you can, but you're gonna find out that that doesn't work really quickly. And in some ways, there's a kind of encouragement in a community of practice, which I'm sure you already feel this. There's an encouragement to be awake, right? To notice, to be present when somebody says something to you, to meet, to accept what comes and meet that completely, and to not be passive about that, about meeting the moment completely, fully. What is it? The third way that I've benefited so much from living in community, in Sangha, is that it actually supported me to have a lot of experiences. You know, Suzuki Roshi said, I have some experience. And even though we in our Zen practice, we value making an effort without a gaining idea, even a goal necessarily. You know, we do learn things. We do grow and develop and deepen our practice over time. But to do that, we need to have experiences. We need to have the experience of practice. I mean, all of you know this. Every time you sit down, it's different. You're having the experience of practice that you're having right now with this body, with this mind, with these circumstances, with these people, with this life. And you're having that experience. And if even for a moment, like Dogen said, you return, you find your place right where you are, practice occurs. But that's not something you can think about. That's not something you can process or work with intellectually. That just has to happen through having the experience of sitting there with this body. So we just have experiences, and then we get up off the cushion and we have more experiences, and more experiences that are in a context of some shared understanding of practice, you know? Even though it's a little sketchy sometimes, and not everybody's, you know, there's differences, it's still. So because you have one experience, you can have another experience, and you can have another experience. That's kind of how practice works. Because you have this experience, you can have a different experience in the next day, in the next week, in the next moment. And if you don't, but if you don't have this experience, you won't have, you know, that experience. So that's kind of how it happens. It's becoming deeper and deeper and deeper as you have experiences. So the fourth thing that happens in a residential community of practice is that you, how do I say this? You learn to not take yourself so seriously. You learn to allow yourself to experiment with how you are in the world. And it's a safe place to be able to do that. I basically, my story is that basically I spent the first 3 years at Tassajara kind of deconstructing myself, and the next 3 years putting myself back together in a different way. And I had to try on a lot of different stuff to be able to do that. And I had to experiment with my life. With every aspect of my life. And be curious and wonder, well, why is that like that? And what if I try this? Maybe I could do that. Maybe I could do this. And there's an aspect of not taking ourselves too seriously that allows for a different kind of way of processing information, you know, a way that's more creative, yields more possibility, follows different paths that may seem like not so productive. Playful even. I don't know what I'm doing even type of thing. And that's okay. That's okay too. When you find your place where you are, practice occurs. And then later on in that same paragraph, Dogen says, here is the way. Here is the way. Here the path unfolds. So there's a sense of finding your place where you are and actually being part of the unfolding of your life. I don't know if any of you will ever end up doing any kind of intensive practice as a monk in a practice center. Maybe, maybe not. But even if that doesn't become a part of your life, you can go and do retreats, you know, even for a week or a weekend, to take yourself out of the entanglements of your life and put yourself into a spiritual or a practice container. Even that is a very powerful thing. And I imagine that most of you have done something like that. So I just want to encourage that. When I was a new student at Tassajara, I at the end of my second practice period, my buddy and we were in the ceremony with the teacher, and who was also a student of Suzuki Roshi's, and my buddy next to me asked the teacher, "What are we learning? What are we learning?" And Mel said, "We're learning to be a human being. We're learning to be a human being. When we find our place where we are, when we experience this human being, when we experience being a human being, practice naturally flows. Practice occurs. Here is the place. Here the way unfolds." So I don't have any sense of what the time is. If there's time for questions or not, or maybe I've gone for too long. I don't know. What do you all think? Question? Any questions? On any subject whatsoever? Please.
Thank you for the talk. Sure. I'm just curious, you mentioned the phase of reconstructing yourself. What were you looking for?
Well, yeah, you know, well, I just decided, you know, I decided I was just going to buy into this whole thing of letting practice kind of work on me. So an aspect of that was not looking for anything, you know. Not looking for, I knew that if I started to, and I can't say that I was 100% great on this because I struggle with it, but whenever I had an idea of what I was looking for, pretty soon I knew that wasn't it. I mean, very soon, right? Because if I was paying attention. And deep inside, I knew that I was looking for a way to feel okay in my life. Just to feel okay. Just to feel like I could accept myself for who I am and not worry about what was happening out there. I suppose that's, yeah, I was looking for that. And whenever that started to, I started to develop a fixed view around what that would look like or feel like, that's when I started to get into trouble. So I just had to let everything go. And trust some process of just learning about myself. What am I? Who am I? What is this body of mine? What's going on? And I had a lot of teachers who also encouraged me and kind of like kept me propped up a little bit because things were falling apart. But yeah, I was looking for to feel okay. Just to feel okay. Just to feel like I could accept myself. Thanks for asking.
Thank you.
Thank you, Robert.
Sure.
So I'm not super clear exactly what your path was. You know, you started in your Thailand monastery and then went to Tasmara. I don't know if there were time gaps or worked in between. I'm curious about the transition between monastic life and everyday life, and whether or not you stayed in the monastery, you still have been somewhat immersed in San Francisco, and you're married, so you have family life. So it's a completely different environment, you know. So how do you transition from, you know, being in a monastery and where everything's highly structured and everyone's practicing together to then go out, you know, or pass by bars where people are getting drunk and, you know, or be with family or things like that?
Right, yeah. That was very challenging. Yeah.
For work, like, I don't know if you work sometimes out of the monastery after you went there, like, part-time or something.
Yeah, you know, I haven't. But my work became very kind of worldly in the position I was in for like 8 years. I had to relate, you know, go to dinners with people and relate to people as if I was just a normal member of society, you know. So that was challenging. You know, it's amazing. It really is amazing. How much following just a regular daily schedule can do for a person. You know, just having the ability to reconnect, touch with that part of you. Reconnect with deepest intention for life, you know, and to do that on a daily basis. So that's one thing. Having a regular practice, you know, it's just so important. And that coming back to that, and knowing that you're going to come back to that, and coming back to that over and over again. And then extending that into the day intentionally, you know, just returning and taking care and taking care of ourselves and returning to that place of
clarity.
Yeah, clarity. Yeah, right. Clarity.
Thank you.
Openness, acceptance. Yeah. The other thing is, you know, I relied on I had friends in the Dharma. I had friends in the community, and I still have them, and they helped me so much. You know, they helped me. I have friends who know who I am, know what I'm trying to do, know what I value, know what I like. In a way, in like a broader sense, that I value kindness and compassion and honesty and I don't really have time for spend time with other people who don't kind of support me on my path in that way. I know that's difficult when you're out in the world, and of course maybe your family's involved and stuff like that, but still, you know, having friends, having Dharma friends, having friends as part of your, even if it's just a kind of a personally constructed Sangha, so important. So important. It doesn't take so many, one or two. So important to kind of keep. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Robert.
Sure.
You
said something that I found intriguing. You mentioned that you had an issue with control and that you had become aware of that. I don't know if you call it a personality trait or something. And it kind of struck something with me. I think there's a question as to whether we take our personalities with us into practice, or is it something we try to, in a sense, transcend? Was there a balance between acceptance and the awareness of character flaws, if you will? Or is there such a thing as a character flaw? Is it? How does one work through that, I guess?
Right, yeah, right. That's a great question. Thing we start to do when we practice is to just notice. Just notice what's coming up for you in the situation. Notice what happens. Say there's some emotional response or some frustration or some energy in a situation with the circumstances. Just to notice, and then, okay, maybe even just with the noticing, there's some action that you take, something you say something, you do something, you drop back, you step in, and you notice that too. And you notice how that feels. And you notice the response that you get from people around you. And you notice how that feels. And then maybe you say something else or you do something else and you notice how that feels. And you find your place. And it's not like there's no rule that says, okay, well, you have to like step back for a while and then you can come forward, or you have to come forward and then you can learn how to step back. That was my point with the fourth thing. You can experiment with these things when it's your practice. You can experiment with it. Well, this is just my practice. I'm going to try this time. See how that feels. See what comes back to me. See what that does. And if you have friends, like I was just talking about, you can check it out with them. How was that? How did I do? I was really hoping that this was going to happen, but it seemed like it didn't, you know, something like that. You can start to not only just notice internal world, external world, but you can, yeah, check things out with people. That's what it is to start to see every all of this stuff, everything as your practice. But there's no rules, you know? It's kind of just notice moment to moment to moment. That's what I also meant by being not being a passive participant in that, but being actively participating in noticing. This feels like this. What is that? Questions are really good. What is that? What is this? What? What's going on? You know, even if it just stays with yourself, but you can also ask that question to other people. What's happening? What do we think is happening here? and then stick around. Stick around for the answer and notice. You might be surprised by what comes. So it's, you know, sometimes there's a saying, sometimes we turn the Dharma wheel and sometimes the Dharma wheel turns us. So you know, sometimes we're coming forward and sometimes and we're making things happen and sometimes things are happening to us and we're just trying to respond and keep up, you know. So, but to notice, to just be there, to find your place where you are when it's all happening, that's the point. Fundamental point, it seems. Does that make sense?
Yes. Thank you.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I noticed that you referred to letting go. For example, letting go of my idea of myself, letting go of how I see people. And you also said I have to let go, which kind of triggered this curiosity about, is this something we can talk about as something in the past, or is this an ongoing thing? Like, we are like magnets and we cling ourselves off those ideas or attachments, and as we are going, moving forward, they'll just collect more. And is this an active process? Is letting go an active process, or is it a passive process? What is that, the passive or active part? I'm just curious about that.
Thank you. The letting go is always going to happen in the present moment. The letting go is not pushing away. Things are always going all the time. Things are always collecting, moving, changing, going all the time. Then sometimes we can try to grab something that's nature is to move. Grab it and stop it from moving. Whether it's our idea of ourself, it's somebody we know, a situation. Usually what we're letting go of is something that we've put on top of, like a story or a story that we put on top of something that isn't necessarily true. You know, so if we're practicing, if we're noticing, we notice that we're doing that. In the present moment, you notice how it feels. You notice that there's some kind of something happening there. It's not flowing. Sometimes we have to ask ourselves, well, what am I holding on to? It's not even apparent to us. We don't even know. We don't even know what's happening. We don't even know what we're doing, but we're doing it, you know, out of habit. This person shows up, I always do this, I always do this, I always respond that way. in every moment, there's the possibility of noticing that, just like I was just talking about. Noticing some constriction, noticing some grasping, some holding on. There's the, in every moment, next moment, is the possibility of noticing that and opening up and letting things just go how they want to go. Because they're going to go anyways. It's just a matter of whether we're going to try to hold it or not. Hold it together. So in some ways, letting go is not just letting go, it's letting come. It's letting things flow. It's letting things happen. You know? And sometimes that feels like from within, and sometimes that feels kind of from without, but yeah. And it happens always. It couldn't happen any other place than right now. That's the only place that can happen. It's in the moment of letting go, of letting it be, letting things be, letting things move, letting things come and go and move any way they want to.
We were together at Tassajara in fall of 96.
Yeah, I remember.
I remember, and I was sick and you brought me my food.
Oh, yeah, right. Because I was the Eno or something, or what?
I don't know, but you had a job. And yeah. It's like out of your free time that you had to do this. So I don't know how happy you were about doing it, but thank you very much.
Yeah, you were miserable there for a while.
Yeah.
I think. Sorry.
I better.
Yes.
But I'm just thinking that, you know, I had, coming back from Tassajara, you know, I had a choice of going out and living in San Francisco or, you know, continuing to live here at home and the practice here every day, well, not this temple, but one close by. And, you know, it looked very attractive to go be part of that community. And I really loved being part of the community. It felt so good, so close. I remember thinking about how, you know, you had 50 people living together for 3 months. And even though you're not talking to very many, you see somebody's elbow and you know who it is.
Mm-hmm.
I think about Tassajara a lot, especially when you think about the schedule and the things that I learned there. And a different way for me for doing my practice has been, you know, to sit here with Les and the Sangha before I go to work every day and go to coffee together. And, you know, I've had a very good life. And, you know, I'm grateful for the background that, and the time I spent at Tassajara. Very grateful.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that, Carolyn. Yeah, it's you know, we can think that well nothing's happening, you know, it's just like so many aspects about practice are just, especially, you know, Zen, Soto Zen practice is just about, well, I think I'll sit down now, or I think I'll clean something now, or maybe we'll go do something together or something like that. It's so very basic. Yeah. So very human.
And you know, I'm glad I made the choice that I did. They work for me. I taught high school for
said that I grabbed my costume like a Zen
Buddhist. Yeah. Yeah. You're still teaching? You're still teaching kids?
No,
oh, okay. Oh. Yeah, I think we find when we practice, just, you know, there's a, there is a Suzuki Roshi quote about experience in Zen mind, beginner's mind, and he says something like, you know, we have the experience of practice and it becomes deeper and deeper over time, and then it says something like, and eventually we resume our true nature. Mm-hmm. Eventually we resume our true nature. And then there's a period, and then it said, well, actually, but actually our true nature resumes us. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
It's also been really good to have President Center in Green Gulch to be able to go to the longer sessions and the practice periods and that kind of thing, which really helped me out a lot. We really don't have, you can't spend the night here for a long period of time and that kind of thing. So to be able to do that, to go and do that, is great.
Yeah. Yeah, Samantha and I are still connected to many people we practice with, you know, in the 90s there. Sorry, we've kind of lost our connection, but it's once you have those experiences together with somebody else,
mm-hmm.
you're friends for life.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's enough for tonight. What do we think? Yeah, okay. Thank you all very much for it.
Thank you.
We have a team this Saturday. I know it seems to be a little later from the announcement, but some sitting, some walking meditation, broken up with breakfast, lunch, and tea and work period, and some a few ceremonies. It's a whole day retreat. Starts at 5:30 in the morning, and goes till 5:30 in the evening, and then we're half an hour clean up and we leave. Day goes by really fast. Sometimes it feels like one today and go to one walking meditation period, but gives us all a slight sense of what it is to practice with the entire Sangha. And I think that is for me, I've taken it, always walked away with a warm feeling. It has always touched me on some level. So do come. If you can't come to the whole Sashin, we don't lock the doors or don't allow people to come in. But when you do come, please do come for a session, two or three sessions, and attend the whole session. I actually would like to encourage people to come to the whole session. But living in where we're living in Silicon Valley, sometimes it's not possible. Do come as much as you can. We still need food for the Sashin. The sign-ups are outside. I made copies and I provide them for people to take home for the schedule. And on the back side are the guidelines, so do look them over. And if you want to take them home, please do take those copies home. and let them over decide for how long you would like to come and do come. We also need people to serve for breakfast, lunch, and tea. So if you like to additionally involve yourself in putting yourself outside your own comfort zone, do try and do that, because that's always a good thing to do. But do come. Saturday is, I think it's going to be a good day to come and sit and, sit with the entire Sangha. And it's the last session of the year for us. So it's very important. It's very good. So, Ken, you have something to say?
After that. Yeah, I think we have one server so far for breakfast, and we need two breakfasts. Keep the cookies, but I just feel that somebody's probably got their eyeballs on the cookie stuff. So that's cool. And so I might hit on a few other people for Saturday if I can go on. But anyway, it's a wonderful opportunity. Something Candle provides for us to do. And it was a fantastic talk tonight, I think, underscores us having a retreat this weekend. So it's just beautiful timing. Anyway, thank you very much.
Yes, I'm Janet. I'm from another town, but now I'm back for the winter. And we scheduled the holiday party for Sunday 20th at my house. It starts at 5 o'clock, and it's a pop-up supper, so I have to come and come. If you're on our email list, you should have gotten an invitation email, but if you did not, I have some printed ones on the table. What the invitation doesn't say is that I'd like to emphasize that families are included, so please bring the significant other and the kids.
Will you be back with me?
Me too.